You are listening to Radio Albion.
Everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. I am Matthew Raphael Johnson, and today is Wednesday, the 11th of May, 2022. My eldest son graduated Penn State on Sunday in psychology, for some reason. All kinds of good things after many years of suffering. Many good things are starting to come together for the first time in a very long time, and I need to say that a lot of you guys who have assisted me and continue to assist me over the years are a big part of it. I dedicated at least one book, I can't remember which, it may have been the Alistair McIntyre book, which I rarely talk about, I should fix that, to my friends and supporters, my listeners. I was on Saturday night with Pastor Eli, the identity guy from Eurofolk Radio. 2 hours live. Check him out. It's a good interview on the situation in Ukraine. I'm already getting tired of this topic, largely because I've said everything that really is important to say. As many of you know, I don't do current events all that much, although obviously things like that are absolutely unavoidable, because here you have the significance comes down to the fact that what was front page news, however badly reported and misunderstood, was connected with our Orthodox history, and especially in the Slavic realm. Of course, this is why no one really knows what's going on there, because the set of assumptions that civilization, ethnic group has, are not shared by those of the liberal West. And as far as other domestic things, I always hold my peace on some of these things that are just developing. It was the abortion issue that first brought me into this back in high school, actually. The great Bill Draghi, who brought me to my first Operation Rescue when I was 17. And that began this extraordinary journey. And of course, when I had my two boys many years ago, I was not working. I had just gotten out of grad school. I was living with my mother very briefly, which was torture. Just got married. And when the second one was born, many of you know who he is, Michael. I was just getting on my feet. There's never a good time to have kids. And yet somehow I made it. The constant struggle is something that once it's all over, you look back on it with a great degree of satisfaction and happiness. In fact, you even miss it after a while. That's what's going on. It's unpleasant. But when you see how you've been victorious over it, becomes a different story. So, I'm not going to deal with the Ukraine issue. But I am going to deal with something else that I've been talking about since maybe around that very time, right after I read Plato when I was in college. Victor DeLugan was my real communist professor who, for some weird reason, was a big fan of mine, who died many years ago, introduced me to the work of George William Frederick Hegel. And if you see in the introduction, the written description that accompanies this lecture, you realize that Hegel is the most difficult philosopher to read, and the phenomenology of spirit is, or some people call it the phenomenology of mind, is one of the most difficult of this incredibly dense body of work. When I first read it, I had no idea what was going on. I read Kant with no problem. I read Aristotle with no problem. I get to Hegel, and I feel like this is in a different language. And initially, this is what attracted me to it. I said, there's something going on here. What could he possibly be saying that he has, you know, 60-page sentences and these crazy mythological descriptions of things? And it's a very eccentric way of writing, to the point where, I mean, he makes up his own vocabulary. Hegel is one of these guys where you have to read a secondary source before you read primary material. It's impossible to read otherwise. You read a book like Clockwork Orange, and yeah, you kind of get the vocabulary as you go along. It may be jarring at first, but for Hegel, you can't understand anything. And of course, everything he writes is multi-volume, massive number of pages, you know. And so most people, most very intelligent people, will just avoid him altogether. But there is simply no way to avoid his influence. Kant and Hegel were the two most influential philosophers of the 19th century. Kant in the late 18th century, and affected everything that came after, including everything right up until today. Hegel was not a teacher of Marx by any stretch of the imagination. Marx was the exact opposite of Hegel. The fact that they used the same method is no more interesting than them using the same language. They both wrote in German most of the time. That's uninteresting. Marx was 13 when Hegel died. And, of course, he wrote a massive critique of the philosophy of right. The philosophy of right is not what I'm going to be dealing with today, by the way. I've dealt with it before. It was a subject of my master's thesis back in St. Louis, '94. But this is far more fundamental than the philosophy of right. Right, you know, the philosophy of justice, essentially, is what he's talking about. So even a word like that, even a word like right, doesn't mean what we how we normally use it. He's referring to a state of justice, not a right that you claim. When I was in grad school, and I continue to have this bias that if I read a political idea, a theoretical, like, you know, Rousseau or Kant or someone like that, I need to know what the broader view of the world is. The politics has to be situated in something. That's why there can't be any such thing as a political theorist or a philosopher without being a historian. And that distorts a lot of these disciplines. Because these guys just didn't pick up a pen and start writing because it was fun. There were things happening, intellectually and politically and socially, that they were responding to. I think we're in a period of time where political thought, maybe, you know, the level of intellect is so low, even among academics. But outside of the academy, there is an explosion of political thought that most people are simply on the outside of. But that doesn't matter, because masses don't make history. Determined, fanatical minorities make history. Some of you may remember, I have an article that's been published in a few places, and a lecture 2 years ago, I think, maybe more than that, on what Hegel meant by dialectics. And I make fun a lot of the very presumptuous people who claim to know what it is. They never cite a single passage, and it's so wrong, including people who claim to be philosophers, who clearly have never read it, and who have somehow discovered this, and it makes them sound smart to use it. And I explained, really, for anything Hegelian, you know, 20 pages is made like a footnote or an introduction to any explanation about anything that Hegel says. I think it ended up being about 15 pages explaining what exactly he meant by dialectics. Not necessarily National Socialists. National Socialists tend to be fairly high. The intellectuals tend to be pretty high functioning. Racialists tend to be very high functioning. Even some of the identity people. But that patriot conservative type is usually very low in their understanding. They still vote for Republicans. They simply don't grasp anything more fundamental than the front page of the newspaper. And they are very dependent on the news media, and they're very dependent on the language that the news media uses, which automatically means that you're the visiting team. They have home field advantage, because not only do they use the words, they define them over time. there's so much about the modern and the postmodern mentality. I really should say postmodern, because modernity was finished by the time Hegel was writing. The Enlightenment had been answered largely by the Romantics and by the Hegelians, especially the right Hegelians. You know, Ivan Ilyin, the famous Russian nationalist and royalist, was a huge fan of Hegel for the same reasons that I am. And he's, you know, he sees dialectics as an ascetic exercise, negating the things that kind of naturally flow from our fallen nature. At the very minimum, I will tell you, kind of like how Dugin views Heidegger, I view Hegel. We have the similar relationship to this, that the greatest fighter, the greatest destroyer of liberal assumptions was George William Frederick Hegel. No one could ignore him. No one hates the guy. Everyone respects him, even though they don't like him sometimes. But they always respect him. Very few men in the last 300 years have been more influential. But Hegel was a, to put it in very general terms, a right nationalist. And I mean that in, again, very broad terms. But of course, that was the basics of the era. The dialectic of the city and the empire was the nation. That's the so-called synthesis, a word, by the way, he never used. I think newness may make my a few professors I had always said newness is the best way to, you know, he never used that triad before in any of his writings. That would be too obvious. But I've written, and of course, you know, my doctoral dissertation was on Michael Oakeshott, who was in the same school as Bosanquet, and were British, more practical-minded Hegelians. So Hegel has been a part of my day-to-day life intellectually for decades now. I don't think you could ever, once you finally grasp a few of the basic concepts, when you read him for the first time, you're never quite the same again. You never view things the same way again. And the reason is that there's no one who sought the fundamentals, that which you can't go beyond, that Hegel did. And no one came as close to succeeding in that respect as Hegel did. Because the ultimate purpose, and I suppose this is the ultimate purpose to any philosophy at all, and the reason for its existence, is that he wants to reach and then outline, lay out the basic fundamental conditions of knowledge. The claim to know something. What kind of relationship has to exist for you to be able to say that you know something? And the revolution that, I guess, Kant began, but it really didn't become practically realized until Hegel, that our mind, I do not notice we don't say the brain, that's a different story. The mind is not a material thing. The mind doesn't grasp things that we think are external to us. And of course, Kant said the same thing. There is no direct grasp between my senses and the microphone that's in front of me, or the book that's in front of you. There is a context that defines both me and what I'm looking at. That context is absolutely essential for knowledge. As we'll see in a little bit, it is, in essence, the language, the ethnic group. That's why the political theory exists at the end of his career, because that's then the practical manifestation of what he's talking about here. Immanuel Kant was one of the most extreme revolutionaries and one of the people who put kind of the early Enlightenment to sleep, because he decried as dogmatism. Now, dogmatism is a technical term in philosophy. It refers to the belief that there is an immediate one-to-one brute correlation between me and the things that confront me every day. It's just the objects in day-to-day life. It really could be anything. It doesn't matter. Objects, sensibles, whatever it might be. No. The nature of things, as far as we're concerned, come from concepts. These are screens that stand between the mind and what's external to us, the world around us. So there is no, nor could there be, any direct relation between the information entering the mind from what our senses tell us on the one hand to our understanding of them on the other. That very naive dogmatic view is at the basis of the empiricists like Locke and positivists, and then, of course, the nominalists who always require that kind of thought in general. Phenomenology of Spirit is a lengthy work. The introduction is, in fact, a work of philosophy in and of itself, which you can spend a decade on. And the first concept to note what's happening here. It's true that concepts mediate material things, or really anything that confronts us in day-to-day. Kant argued that these were inherent to the human mind, and they were always the same, no matter what point in history you were, or what language you spoke. That's what made him very much an Enlightenment philosopher, that this was simply a universal condition for reason, to function. The opposite of dogma was critique. So the idea of dogma is the empirical idea that there's something in front of me, and that's all there is. It's two of us, and I can understand it as is. The brute matter, brute objects, brute givens. And the critique is, well, where does this understanding come from? It isn't given to us by the object itself. Right? We have words for it. Those words don't come from the object themselves. And how do you distinguish between essence and accident? How do you distinguish between how something is viewed in society versus how something really is? There's a million ways to rip this apart. Dogma in the philosophical sense is nonsensical. This is why language is so important. This is why people like Hegel took Kant and revolutionized how we view the world and made it into what amounts to an ethnic and national context. The mind for Hegel, and this is something that I think most of us, even today, even those outside of any kind of nationalism, have to accept, that the mind is a collective thing. It's the result of many millennia of development. I'm not talking about biologically. I'm talking about in terms of its historical and linguistic and scientific history. Everything that we're surrounded with, you know, if we're critical and we're readers, we read about the ancient world, about the medieval world, about the Renaissance, and different cultures around the planet, our mind becomes this repository of different claims to truth. It's really hard to even speak a sentence without, in a sense, making some kind of claim to truth, or something is real when it isn't, or the opposite. Mental illness, as I've been saying for most of my life, mental illness is, every single one of them, is based on delusion. That the sick person believes something is there when it is not, or the reverse. They swear something is not there when in fact it is. This could be a lot of different things. And what mental illness is a different aspect where that can be the case. You know, even depression. Depression isn't so much being miserable. That's pretty stupid. I mean, everyone's miserable from time to time. It's being miserable for no good reason. Because this is not a matter of what's happening around us. A depressed person could live in a palace and be healthy and happy and have women everywhere and be absolutely miserable. And you're looking at this guy, you know, how could this possibly be? Whatever you consider, you know, the goal in life, you have it. And yet the depressed person, it's because the depressed person doesn't, the filters, the concepts that stand between the external world and how they comprehend things are distorted. That this person who can have everything you could ever want, and yet he doesn't view it that way. He views it as something, you know, he will block out the positive things and he will allow in only the negative things. So someone gives you a compliment, you're intelligent or you're in good shape or whatever they might say, and you say, well, thank you very much, I appreciate it, I'm working on it. The depressed person will hear the exact same compliment and think to himself, he's only saying this because he wants to be nice, or he wants something from me, or he thinks I'm retarded and needs to be told like a child. That's how the depressed person operates. And it's no different than what Hegel's talking about here, although that's a distortion. That the world is mediated and filtered by things. My book on nominalism is coming out soon. And I've spoken on this show before, lectured, written on it, but what sin really does We talked about Neil Sorsky a few weeks ago, what sin does when it becomes a habit, when it takes over, is when it now colors everything that you see and hear. If your sin is lust, or if it's greed, everything serves that agenda. Everything is twisted. Everything becomes sexualized. Everything becomes financial, some means for you to exploit in one form or another. All of this, Hegel took into consideration and Kant before him. Hegel made a lot more sense because history is what filled in the content of these screens that stand between the world and us. There's always a tension. I mean, the mind is a collective reality. It's not an abstraction. The mind isn't the same for different people around the planet. There's a certain tension that exists between, on the one hand, our grasp of a thing, which could be true, could be false, could be all over the place, and there's the requirement for it being universally true. And Heidegger does make a big deal about this. How we conceive of something really isn't important. It's what it is in reality. Now, you can have a distorted, sick society like we live in, where things like, for example, sexuality has had its own concept so badly distorted that people think a homosexual union is quote-unquote sexual. It is not. Or that they could be married in that mockery of the term. That their marriage is as good as mine, which is the claim that is a result only of brainwashing. The concept that from which information is filtered is a result of manipulation and brainwashing. So these concepts that stand between the thinker and the world around us can be distorted and can be attacked, but that is still how we come to know something. There is always going to be a tension because we want objects to dominate them. We want to have them, we want to manipulate them, exploit them, whatever the object might be. Even changing the definition of words to suit our interest, or if we're going to lie about something, how we're going to totally remake our life so someone thinks we're someone that we're not. But that's not what our minds are made for. Our minds are made for understanding the real, the true, not what we want. And of course, for Aristotle, it was bringing the two things into one unity. And Hegel, it's the same thing. These are blueprints for how understanding comes to function. So the earliest thing, the most primitive aspect of this, Hegel calls sense certainty. I remember taking notes on this so many years ago. The mind struggles to understand the world around it in a very limited sense. But that's purely subjective. In the West, we take for granted this notion that I could look at something like a car, you know, or a horse or something like that, and there's just a one-to-one relation. I'm seeing this horse. And that's far from the case. Hegel's not going to go so far as to say it's constructed. But that the way we understand, even using the word and where the word horse comes from, Heidegger talked about how words have to be understood from their origin to understand what it really means, which is what got me into, you know, seeing how words have been distorted and changed over the decades. There isn't this one-to-one connection. But without language, we're just looking at something and there's no name for it. It's just a purely primitive, subjective perception and absolutely nothing more. We don't even have a conception. There's no language, so it's non-communicative. It's purely subjective, it's purely personal. Well, that might be subjective, but our minds are not made for this. Perception, consciousness is developing. It's searching for reliable foundations. How do I know what I'm seeing is real? Begins the reflection on itself. Over time, history is a creation of these communal categories. The crude first appearance of the ethnic principle. The ideas we use to describe things are not the things. Let's say that you've taken a vacation in Barbados. You come home and you explain to people what exactly you did out there. You explain the beach and the palm trees and everything else. The person who's hearing it, what are they thinking? See, if words completely gave information, with complete, it's all you needed for information was words, then hearing about a vacation would be the same as taking one. Because there'd be no distinction between reality and the words. Well, obviously that's not true. Words then only become a piece of it, but a pretty important piece of it. The ideas we use to describe things are shaped by language, not to mention its context and what it originally means, what words actually mean. The names of things we see are connected to the objects themselves, and I'm not going to get into the name worship thing here, but this is where it comes from. The names of things we see is worked out culturally. Heidegger was very much into this topic too. But it doesn't mean that this is objective, just because a bunch of us might agree as to what a tree or a horse is, or what justice is, means nothing. Being intersubjectively true doesn't make it objectively true. So consciousness, and this is with developing our own sense of ourselves, consciousness is always pulled in two different directions. Subjectivity on the one hand, and a fake objectivity. And there, but it's simple, but that's how he begins here. Our senses report things to us, but in and of themselves, they don't mean very much. Kant called this the manifold. It was pure flux for him. But we are forced to make sense out of this stuff and define and discover what the reality is. And the categories are the first step. And the fact that these two things are different from one another means that something even more fundamental has to be found. Okay, you have words, and then you have the reality that the words are trying to describe. Neither one of them, in and of themselves, are sufficient. So what is it that both have in common? What is the fundament that they both take part in? That's really what dialectics comes down to. The reality and the word. Both of them, in and of themselves, tell me nothing. It's certainly not universal, it's not true, in terms of it's not real. That automatically means there has to be an even more fundamental reality underneath both of those things. That's the first mode of seeking rational foundations and certainty. That's what our minds exist for, but we are never individuals. Hegel tore apart the concept of individualism for this very reason. Do you create the language that you demand your individual rights in? Or how about the rights themselves? Or even how to demand something? Or the money that you have, the job that you have, the family that you have, everything that you are, none of it is yours. That's a simple fact of life. The fact that someone like him had to explain this very obvious truth to people just shows you that even in his day, the early 19th century, society was falling to pieces, and Napoleon certainly, although Hegel was very pro-Napoleon, that kind of chaos was not helping matters. Hegel's famous book, The Science of Logic, which I really don't. I mean, I had to read this a long time ago, and it really was torture. I'd rather read the Talmud. Hegel begins The Science of Logic, the book, by demonstrating that the categories of thinking through and in which we grasp things, they're not stable, and they're not certain in and of themselves, like Hegel seemed to, I mean, sorry, that Kant seemed to suggest. And he uses an example. And I remember as a young man, this blew my mind. He uses the fundamental, what we think is the fundamental universal category, and that is being. Something is, or it is not. And Hegel thinks about that for a minute. To be able to say that anything is, or that being itself is, implies, without question, that there's also the possibility that nothing is, or that not being is, which means that being always implies nothingness, and vice versa. You can't call to mind one category without invoking the other. So even the concept of being isn't fundamental enough. Because the minute you mention that something is, or that being exists, which almost seems absurd, the implication, or the word would be useless, that not being also is. Therefore, being and nothingness turn out to be the same. That's a thesis and an antithesis, to use those words. So clearly, even being isn't fundamental. Those two things clash and form what Hegel would call becoming. Becoming is the synthesis of things that is and things that are not, because becoming is you're heading towards something, but you're not there yet. But the fact that you're heading towards something means to some extent you have to have that in you. So it can be and not be at the same time. Becoming captures both nothing and being at the same time. That's how thought moves. And Hegel's model was extremely systematic and hard to reject. Even the scholastics had a very powerful concept of becoming coming from. And the Orthodox do too. That's what we mean by energy. That's what energy is. Consciousness posits the most basic categories, which almost the minute it's uttered engenders a contradiction. Being has to be connected to nothingness, or the word is meaningless. So that means it's negated, it falls apart right away, which means we need a far more complex category that smooths over, that deals with, that mends together this contradiction. The new category, becoming itself, will in turn reveal its own contradiction, which will point to something else until we get to the absolute. The next step is, I know this is a very simple explanation, but is the term essence. He doesn't use the word essence the same way that most of us will, that Platonists or Aristotelians will use the word. Book two begins, and essence is a more complex mode of being. Because if you just utter, being exists, of course it's connected with nothing, therefore you get becoming, that still doesn't answer the question. Because so far you're not even talking about yourself. Who's the one who's doing this? Who's the one who's doing this perceiving? What do you care? Consciousness of being attempts to get at objects through the, X or not X dualism. Empirical ideology, the simple idea. A is not A. Or, I'm sorry, either A or not A. X or not X. It can't be both at the same time. Essence, though, in this definition, which is why Hegel's so problematic, because he doesn't use words in the same sense, and English and German are fairly close. I took German in college and was very frustrated. Well, I only took German because of this. Essence points to qualities that's beyond mere existence or non-existence. You say that an object is red, it's a quality. Well, this red seems to be an eternal thing. Can you conceive of the color red without conceiving of a red something? So what the heck is this redness? What is manifest here in appearance? So instead of being or not being, becoming, objects appear to have different natures. Being and essence are both features of what we call objective logic. They pertain to the qualities of objects themselves, and we haven't even gotten to our own self yet, which is a big part of this that's being left out so far. The subjective nature of logic gets at what are called ideal properties of knowledge, products of the mind, things like concepts or filters or notions, whatever term you want to use. We could also use archetypes in Jung's sense. That is then the third and highest level of consciousness. The attempt is to bring subjective and objective together. Knowledge can't even begin unless those two things are overcome. Now, the old adage is that demons can't count beyond two. They only see X or not X. They don't see things that are beyond that kind of very simple logic. What can bridge X and not X? Things like humility, which are extremely foreign to demons. Demons only know the individual in society. There is no, it's this perpetual constant frustration, or hell itself. Perpetual constant, it's like a passage of music that doesn't have a resolution. To have subjective and objective as currently at war with one another is pure destruction and pure frustration. The nation, more so than any other object, has attempted to do just this. And Hegel's politics will go about this in some great length. But this concept, that's the domain of what we call metaphysics. Ultimately, it comes down to the interrelation of ourself and our consciousness on the one hand, and then what is around us objectively on the other. Phenomenology, there's a million ways to define it. But it's when the self is brought into concepts of knowledge. It isn't just the object in front of me. It's also that I'm the one doing the knowledge, doing the learning, and therefore receiving some sort of knowledge. Consciousness, whether it be intersubjective or otherwise, is normally not talked about when it comes to the positivist or empirical, Lockean idea, the anomalous idea. Phenomenology is spirit, lays out its own sense of dialectic, that the idea that along with the concept of spirit, this is our, the Holy Spirit, as Ilin would say, the collective mind in true unity, in the science of logic, Hegel wants to show that there's this process, our consciousness assimilates the things around us into mental concepts that are far more dynamic than anything that Kant ever said. So it's the tracing and movement of consciousness with the idea, not in Plato's sense, consciousness is the idea, from the most basic categories to the more complex ones. And more, by more complex, I mean the more comprehensive. Consciousness first grasps things, objects, at the most basic level. But of course, that's unsatisfying. That tells us nothing. There's no concept of context or the self or anything. There's always going to be inadequacies or contradictions. Even today, can you comprehend a tree without understanding the soil from which it comes, the air that it requires, the sunlight? In fact, can you talk about a tree without talking about everything else in creation? The answer is no. This is why logos theology is so important. Consciousness grasps not a basic object like a tree, but trees by itself? But that's meaningless. Why even separate a tree from everything else around it? They're equally, certainly, dependent on one another. It seems to be a matter of practical reason. Whenever you do that and you want to talk about an ecosystem, okay, that's going to be incomplete, because what's that based on? Then you have to have greater and greater, more and more comprehensive entities before you could even claim to know anything. This is the dialectical unfolding. I'm using Schelling's language, but it's an inherent feature of the world around us. This governs history, this governs culture, this governs civilization. The war between objective and subjective, which the mind is designed to overcome. A and not A, by themselves, are not how the world functions. That's how a very crude, sinful, unredeemed man views the world. The dialectic in the logic is phenomenal. It's a phenomenal idea, but two dimensions, aspects of reality and our idea, the mental conceptual grasp of things, they're not separable. In the same sense, you can't be a father without having a child. You can't be a child without having a mother and father. That doesn't make sense. The definition of fatherhood means that you have a son. This is why the Trinity is what it is. You can't talk about a father without talking about a son. You're not a father if you don't have a son. Yes, the world as we live in is created by ideas in both Jung and Plato's sense. But they certainly don't emanate from the mind of a single living person. This isn't inherent just abstractly in the human mind. Concepts have an objective status in the same sense that Plato's ideas do. But Hegel puts Plato on an even more complex footing. These realities exist outside of any individual, of course. Knowledge is doomed, science is doomed if you make it purely subjective. But for our purposes, the common cultural understanding, which is another way of saying ethnicity, and it's ridiculous, philosophers don't want to use that term because God forbid they start sounding like me. This is the beginning of how we can overcome these constant contradictions that we see everywhere. You hear these dumb Republicans, especially the libertarians, talking about that the only two realities are the collective and the individual, and we fight for the individual. As if there can be no third object. Because if that's true, then it's constant warfare and no problems will be solved. They can't mean that. The phenomenology of spirit, our own consciousness, human consciousness even collectively, starts from a position of trying to understand things around us through sense. And then, of course, moves on to more sophisticated ways of relating to the external world until the level of spirit or the all-comprehensive thing, which is, of course, the Trinity, there's nothing else it could be, is reached and understood to the extent the human can. And this is also as Ivan Illin's understanding of Hegel. Consciousness understands that individual things and even individual people are bond bound, I should say, to each other as a single communal consciousness, because there could be no talk, there could be no life, there could be no economy, there could be nothing unless we had a similar language and were willing to fight for one another. This is why there was no such thing as cavemen, this nonsensical 19th century ideology. You can't create a human being without at the same time creating the rudiments of civilization. After the civilization of the garden was removed from us. Beyond that, though, spirit is the self-consciousness of the ethnic community. You can't talk to me about community without talking about ethnicity. It's hard to talk about ethnicity without talking about race, in the very broad sense of the term. And these exist in these nesting less to more comprehensive realities. Individuals. My God, you talk about a drop in the ocean. Now, you have individuals like Kant and Hegel, who are far more significant than we will ever be. But even there, they are a part of this developing conceptual apparatus. The consciousness of this spirit unfolds and continues to change, but not randomly change. Our values don't so much change, but they become more and more complete. You think of how dogma, and dogma in the religious sense now, where doctrine comes into existence. The synods were called local or ecumenical, at times of chaos, at times where no one knew what was going on. Some new ideas had come in and did a lot of damage to the community. So the highest levels, the ascetics, the bishops had to get together and hammer this out, hear all sides and understand what has the tradition really been. We have to now clarify. We're not adding anything. We are clarifying things. The synodal system, therefore, is an imitation of how we come to know things collectively. There is no such thing as individual knowledge. Everything I know comes from all my reading and study, professors, both positive and negative. I didn't come out of the womb talking about Hobbes. And it's not an accident that Thomas Hobbes himself does not talk about children. Only full-fledged adults that, according to him, come up out of the ground like mushrooms. Because families don't make any sense, in his point of view. Consciousness of an object implies consciousness of you. Anytime we talk about what something is, we're talking about our interest in what something is. Knowledge is self-knowledge to that extent. The self that perceives the object. But even the term self alone means nothing. Self where? With what motivations? What civilization? What are the assumptions that this self is bringing to the world? Men are not just conscious of objects and things around them and problems to solve, but of ourselves in the process. Now, I always described, in the most simple way, I described Hegel's understanding of metaphysics as this. The individual looks at an object. Let's say the individual wants to understand what justice is. Justice would be the object. We come to study everything that justice could possibly be, and we start realizing something. Not only are we learning more about it, but we're changing. If we have a goal, let's say we want to come to understand what justice is, we keep piling up knowledge and understanding and negation and synthesizing everything and going from greater and greater comprehensive understandings of the subject, we as selves are changing. What we're looking for may now go beyond justice because we know a heck of a lot more than before. All knowledge takes this form. Intelligence is the ability to synthesize, to go from more and more, from less comprehensive to more comprehensive terms. Then Hegel will take this farther and say, So the self looks at the object then changes the self then looks at the object again, and it goes back and forth. When we come to know things, it's not that we come to learn something, but we also change fundamentally. And that changed thing, that changed person, then goes back to the original subject and sees it differently. This is how history functions. This is how we learn anything. That's why Elin would call the dialectical method an ascetic method. nothing good. This process is painful. We are not just conscious of things around us, but also that we are learning about something. We're not just, you know, our minds is a human locks. Our mind is just a stage where objects just, you know, travel back and forth. No, it's more than a stage. We help create objects. Not in the sense that it's purely subjective. But an object never exists by itself, just like our own selfhood never exists by itself. It's absurd. It's what we call an abstraction. So take it a step further. So self-consciousness involves not just a subject and an object, but by definition, other subjects. It includes other people. There can be nothing of just an individual by himself. You couldn't survive for 2 minutes. Therefore, by definition, you know, Descartes' cogito, it's a very bizarre thing because it doesn't go far enough. I believe it was McClarkus who made a central argument, one that I've come to accept, where he says, the cogito, the idea that I cannot deny my own existence, therefore my existence has to be the fundamental ultimate truth. No. What is your existence based on? You can't be by yourself. Therefore, there has to be a community that's just as fundamental as you. Not to mention, where did you come from? You didn't create yourself, right? So there must be a God that created you. That's just as fundamental in Descartes' cogito ergo sum as his idea that my existence is the only thing that's real. Or at least the only thing that's fundamental. You can't deny your own existence. Try to deny your own existence. Well, who's doing the denying? It's ridiculous. Because denying it is a contradiction, it must be undeniable. And you think of the destruction that that concept wrought, where the only fundamental thing is you, trapped in this subjectivity. McClarkus tore Descartes apart by saying, okay, even if you come to the conclusion, okay, I can't get anyone, I can't deny my own existence. Therefore, that's the ultimate fund, the one thing I cannot deny, the one thing I'm 100% certain is true. It doesn't go far enough, because what else does that imply? Any object of science, philosophy, has to assume an entire society and civilization. There is no abstract, naked things like numbers. These are all icons. Men become aware of themselves because there are others looking at us. Hegel used the concept of recognition as a central philosophical concept. We become self-conscious, not just because we learn things, but because we also know that others are learning things too, and may be interested in what we have to say. May like us, may not like us. There is no such thing as an individual because the individual cannot exist of its own accord. For Hegel, what's real is what exists of its own accord. And the only thing that could possibly be is the Trinity, not accidentally made up of three persons in one Godhead. Therefore, true self-consciousness is a social process by definition. As it said, it involves a moment of radical identification, as some say, with other subjects. You have to take on the view of another's view of the world to obtain any kind of self-image. You could call yourself a giraffe, or if you're a man, pretend that you're a woman, which is more the same thing. But unless other people recognize that, then that's not what you are. They don't recognize it because it's almost a definition of insanity. This is why the regime has to use the policeman's club to force you to believe that you can be a giraffe or that homosexual sex is actually sex and is equal to anything I might do with my wife. This is the height of insanity. So it has to be forced. Consciousness of ourselves is always a consciousness of others, and vice versa. That's the very nature of culture. You can't talk about anything without talking about language. So Hegel's ideas differ from Kant's and many others in a few different ways. And one of the central ways, and one of the things that got me so anxious to learn more about Hegel many years ago, is that the ideas that we have of the world, the things, the filters we have to construct the world around us and ourselves, are social. Knowledge and science is social. It's communal. It's national. Not to say that there is no objective truth, quite the contrary. But there's no such thing as an abstract truth. The ideas that we possess as people are completely and comprehensively shaped by the ideas that other people possess. There is a primitive stage where intersubjective truths are real, but we can't stop there. Of course our minds have been shaped by the thoughts of other people. You didn't create the English language. You didn't create logic. You didn't create the sciences. The trillions of pages that have been written on every area of human life. We didn't discover the Trinity. I go back to Macrocus's critique of Descartes. Okay, if the one thing that you can't deny without self-contradiction is your own existence, it doesn't stop there. Just as fundamental as your own existence is the fact that others have to exist too, or else you would starve to death. You can't exist. You're not a spirit. Not to mention, you have to know what a spirit is. And of course, you're not self-created. Therefore, God must exist. That's inherent to the human mind. But those are still fairly fundamental things. And I don't want to go so far as saying that spirit, in the sense of the phenomenology of spirit, is just a name for collective realities. That's true only up to a point, and it changes. But these things do shape the ideas of every person, every citizen. The other way that Hegel differs from Kant. God, when I was in grad school, I took two doctoral level classes on Immanuel Kant, one on the Critique of Practical Reason, one on the Critique of Pure Reason. And it was really very enjoyable part of my life. Most people suffered with him. I never did. Hegel's a different story. The way Hegel differs from Kant is that he sees spirit as, you know, in the true sense, developing over time. According to, and this is one way to put it, the same kind of pattern, for example, that the two sides in an honest argument may change. That's what the dialectic is supposed to be. Not very few people are capable of that. I mean, conversation is dead now because there's simply only the ego. You know, the thesis idea, which I don't like using, you know, a proposition about something that we think we know. But every statement we make contains its opposite. You know, this is something that Marx used. An owner of capital suggests that they are those who capital requires, but are not owners. For every master, there's a slave, and that's actually Hegel's a central concept in him. Every idea that we may put forth in a sentence has flaws and inherent contradiction, which, by the very nature of reality, will give rise to its opposite, the proposition that contradicts it. And those two come together, and they're reconciled. Now, this isn't just a practical matter. This is inherent to the ideas themselves. This is how reality unfolds. This is how the Holy Spirit unfolds. This is how our understanding of the world unfolds. And this is how we're purified. It's very simple to say. And others have said this before. But Hegel sees a society evolving the same way that an argument will develop over time. That ideas will develop over the time if people are being honest. And notice that when people are being honest, people are actually interested in truth rather than ego. Phenomenology comes down to the notion that the consciousness of objects around us necessarily implies and includes an awareness of the self that actually does the thinking. And of course, the self implies other selves. And in fact, it implies civilization. There can't be a self without a civilization in the broad sense of the term. I'm not using exact language here, the culture, for lack of a better term. But this has to be different from the object that we're looking at. But our selfhood, which for the most part is what we would call inchoate, it's in pieces, non-integral, goes a little further and asserts that subjects are also objects to other selves. Self-consciousness is the awareness that other people are aware of me, and they're aware of themselves, and they're aware of what relationships are developing. Other selves exist, in other words, and have priorities of their own. Self-awareness can only come into existence because other people perceive us. The perception of other people, within the natural context, of course, is essential to who we become. You know, if you decide that I'm going to be a juggler, I'm going to do nothing but juggling tennis balls all day, no one is going to consider that a legitimate, productive, unless you work for the circus, a legitimate and productive enterprise. Yeah, objectively, that's the case. But as far as your development and sense of self is concerned, it's the subjective stuff that's going to bother you. No one's going to take you seriously. Someone says they're a woman, you laugh at them. A man says they're a woman, you laugh at them. They just lay off the soy products, get an injection of something to take yourself out of this psychotic break you're having. This is where brainwashing comes in. You have to force people to think that. You have to threaten people to think that. But even if you do it, even if you succeed in forcing everyone to think that a man identifying as a woman is a woman, it doesn't change a damn thing. That's just forced everyone to shut up. Its subjective part has been cut off, but the objective part will not go away. Self-awareness exists because others perceive us. Hegel calls this the struggle of recognition and is essential to the phenomenology of spirit. This is what I said, the mythical structures of Hegel's thought. It's opposing tendencies. They arise from the development of self-consciousness, because it's not just consciousness of me, it's self-consciousness of you. And then the fact that there is a me and you. Things are getting complicated here. The moment when our self and other selves come together, we become self-conscious. The revolutionary break is when someone is conscious of the other. The otherness and our pure self-conscious are violently opposed to one another. This is where Hegel gets even weirder. Two people come together. Even Jean-Paul Sartre, the existentialist, say this. The first instinct isn't to understand, it's to dominate. Two people are bound in a very general and abstract dependency. What happens is that at a very general level, there will be a slave and there will be masters. In every duality between two people, one will somehow dominate the other. This is a primordial relation between two men. Freedom and equality do not exist at this point. Again, this is mythical in the true sense of the word. Because one is aware that the master sees the other as an object rather than a subject, the desire for recognition as an actual subject rather than an object is frustrated. This is a very German idea. And for Hegel, it kind of comes out of nowhere. It comes to some extent from Thomas Hobbes. But it's a very primitive level. Even Johann Fichte, someone who's spoken about in national circles from time to time, but he says that he was just prior to Hegel, in between Kant and Hegel. We become conscious of our own autonomy by being challenged, called upon, as you might say, by the actions of another subject. We can only grow through this struggle. Only by understanding that someone else's actions are intentional and meant to dominate or to control, then we could understand our own actions as expressions of some sort of defense. This is a dialectical movement of recognition, and it's the same thing as how thought develops. The self-conscious at this primitive level struggles to assimilate and humanize everything around it while having to fend off the claims of other subjects, other humans. And by human, we mean something that's both rational and free. The two things imply one another. Hegel argues that reason brings consciousness, of course, to fit what we see and hear into universal categories. But there's always going to be an element of uncertainty here. Objects can exist in a fluid spectrum, as someone else, I can't remember who it was, who put it that way. categories require foundation. The idea in the phenomenology is men gaining self-consciousness as autonomous agents only by interacting with others. But there are differing forms of mutual recognition. The nation implies that free and rational people and families recognize the significance of the others and don't seek to dominate them utterly. But even for Hegel, Thomas Hobbes wasn't so much the idea of a struggle for survival, but recognition. It's a moral question. State of nature. We've talked about, you know, state of, look it up if you don't know. Relationships are kind of automatic. No human being can exist without society. This is why Hobbes, Locke, and Rousseau are disasters intellectually. It's based on sand. And Hegel says that the person who will attack your property doesn't want to gain material goods. Those attacking your property are saying to you that I am a person with a superior moral standing. My claims on the world are greater than yours, and therefore I could steal whatever I want, but you can't. In fighting against this, we have to respond. Subject ourselves, we'll affirm freedom by proving our claims are just as important as theirs. If we allow someone to do as they please, this isn't a matter of humility, this is self-destruction. And does no favors for the developing society. Fighting is an expression of very, very primitive freedom. But it does lead to an impasse. And with Thomas Hobbes said the exact same thing. Either the subject dies and the other one continues, or one becomes a slave to the other. And I'm going to end this. We're going to have to do a part two here. We're going to end this by saying the master-slave relation is extremely dominant. It's not just, don't think of slavery in the normal sense. There's a lot of different forms of dependency. The master and the slave, neither one are free. Because the master isn't a master without the slave. The master isn't really free because it requires the labor of the slave. Without the slave, the master is nothing. That changes everything. If anything, the slave is more powerful because it seems that the slave could live without the master. The master can't be a master without the slave. Anyway, guys, I'm going to be away for a few days. I apologize for not getting back to some of you. I'm going to be back on Saturday, and I'm going to do the Thursday show on location in Ohio. I'll be speaking to you then. I appreciate you, as always, for listening, and I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.